Questioning Paul Chapter 3 Part 2 Yerushalayim, Source of Reconciliation.
Since this has been Shaul's personal revelation, his testimony, and his race against Yahusha's disciples, and, indeed, his pursuits against everything Yahweh has established and offered, in the context of him running this race, it is time we return to chabaqwq/Habakkuk. While we briefly considered Yahweh's foreboding testimony through this largely unknown prophet in the previous chapter, this time we will linger and be more thorough. But first, this reminder. Shaul wrote.
Later, through 14 years, also, I went up to Jerusalem along with Barnabas, having taken along also Titus. 2 verse 1, I went up, but then downward from uncovering an unveiling revelation which lays bare, laying down to them the beneficial messenger which I preach among the races down from my own, uniquely and separately, but then to the opinions, presumptions, and suppositions, not somehow perhaps into foolishness and stupidity, without purpose or falsely, I might run or I ran, 2 verse 2.
With this in mind, Yahweh's haunting prediction regarding Shaul begins by telling us that God isn't about to alter any of the requirements to participate in his covenant or change the approach that he has taken to facilitate our salvation by way of his invitations. This alone is sufficient to put Shaul in opposition to Yahweh.
Upon my requirements and responsibilities, I have decided I will literally and continually stand. And I will choose to always stand and present myself upon that which protects and fortifies. So then I will be on the lookout what he will say about me. Then how can I be expected to change my attitude, my thinking, or my response, my disapproving rebuke? Habakkuk 2 verse 1.
Just as God announced that he would be on the lookout for the likes of Shaul, ever ready to disapprove and rebuke him or anyone suggesting that God has changed his plans or approach, so should we have been. And specifically Shaul, because no one else in all of human history fits this prophecy besides him. He not only tried to change God's requirements, specifically his stand on participation in the covenant relationship and the path to salvation, replacing God's approach with his own. He claimed to speak for God while consistently contradicting and undermining him. And that is why Yahweh has introduced this prophecy in this way. By affirming that he isn't going to replace his specific requirements for participating in the covenant with something as nebulous as faith, especially in grace, nor shirk his own personal responsibilities, whereby he has promised to become the living embodiment of his approach to salvation through his participation in Passover, unyeasted bread, first fruits, and seven Sabbaths. God has established himself as being forever disapproving of Christianity, based as it is upon Shaul's repudiation of the Torah. A connection worth noting in what follows is that Shaul's preferred conduit of misinformation was letters, often large and distinct ones from his own hand. And not only has Shaul admitted that he was running, he should have been, just as we should be running away from him.
Then Yahweh answered, approaching me, and he said, write this revelation, and then expound and reiterate it using those letters upon writing tablets so that, by reciting this, he might run. Habakkuk 2 verse 2.
Yahweh realized that Shaul would attempt to deceive his children. Therefore, he not only warned us about him, he provided the means to rebuke him so that we would not be fooled by him. Therefore, by reciting this prophecy, we distance ourselves and all who will listen from Shaul and his letters. Yahweh finds the perpetrator of this scheme sufficiently deadly to warn us specifically about him, and that is because this charlatan would claim that God had authorized him to undermine his credibility and competence. The lines of demarcation being so clear, and the consequences being so severe, Yahweh left no doubt whatsoever regarding this man, naming him, as we shall soon see, in the prophecy. And while only one man is guilty of every charge which is being laid out before us, which is why he is identified in the third person masculine singular throughout, there are three additional men who have earned a rebuke of this magnitude. So pushing aside the principal culprit for a moment, chronologically, the first of the remaining three is Rabbi Akiba. He was responsible for establishing the Jewish religion as it is practiced today. He was a schemer of the highest order, and extremely arrogant, but not much of a writer. And while he operated in Jerusalem, his promotion of the false Messiah Bar Kokhba in 133 CE led to the Israelites being thrown out of Yahudah and to the diaspora in Europe. It's so immediately obvious to anyone other than an Orthodox Jew that his proclamations were deadly, there would be no reason to waste a prediction on him. Then there was Muhammad, the self-proclaimed messenger of God, and while his Quran recital in 600 CE in Arabia was based upon Kara, the verb of the last sentence, 2 verse 2, he spoke for Allah, not Yahweh, and he was illiterate. Moreover, a literate person wouldn't need this warning to remain clear of Muhammad's verbal diarrhea, because he was simply too stupid for words. There would have been no chance whatsoever that someone reading Yahweh's prophets would have been fooled by Allah's messenger. Although it is interesting to note that while Muhammad claimed that his Quran confirmed the Torah, it is actually its antithesis. And while called a prophet, Muhammad never got one prophecy right. One millennia after Akiba and five centuries post-Muhammad, Maimonides codified the principles of Judaism. He was a prolific writer, but rather than change the Torah, he preferred instead to augment it and then misinterpret it. Maimonides, however, was never in Israel, as he lived his whole life around Muslims, not Jews, in Islamic Spain, Morocco, and Egypt. Also, like Akiba, the Rambam never pretended to speak for God. Collectively, these men deceived billions, but they did not promote their delusions during the mode, meeting times, something common only to Shaul, and which we shall learn in a moment is germane. Shaul alone was in Jerusalem when Yahusha was fulfilling the mode microly, invitations to be called out and meet with God, and he not only became infamous for his letters, he was a rabbi who did an about-face to attack God from an entirely new direction. Further, Shaul admitted to being conceited and demon-possessed, things which will enlarge in a moment. Speaking through the prophet Chabaqwq around 600 BCE, it would be six centuries before Shaul would question God's word, earning Yah's disapproval and punishment. Therefore, Yah encouraged those who first read these words to be patient. This warning was for another day.
Still indeed, this revelation from God is for the appointed meeting time. It provides a witness to and speaks in the end. The extended period of time required for this question to be resolved shall not prove it false. Expect him in this regard, because indeed, he will absolutely come, neither being delayed nor lingering. Habakkuk 2 verse 3.
The first four mode meeting times, Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot, were fulfilled by Yahusha, and the set-apart spirit in year 4000 Yen, more commonly known as 33 CE. They enable the covenant's promises and our salvation. Shaul was in Jerusalem at the time training to be a rabbi. Shortly thereafter, he began undermining them. I find it interesting that now, in 2013, just 20 years shy of Yahweh's return, we are reading this prophecy and identifying it with Shaul. Better late than never, I suppose. As bad as this is, it is about to get much worse. This specificity suggests that Yahweh read Shaul's letters and is responding to them.
Pay attention, he will be puffed up with false pride. His soul, it is not right nor straightforward in him. So then through trust and reliance, those who are upright and vindicated. Habakkuk 2 verse 4.
While narrowing in on Shaul in the first stanza, in the second, Yahweh reminds us that vindication and life everlasting come to those who trust and rely on his firmly established and always dependable testimony. This is and always has been the antidote for religion, especially Paul's Christianity. And yet in Galatians 3 verse 11, in the midst of his initial assault against the Torah, Shaul misquotes this verse, the very one which condemns him for mocking God, removing it from its context and truncating it, all to promote a faith based on ignorance.
But because with regard to the Torah absolutely no one is vindicated or justified by God becomes evident because those who are vindicated, justified, and righteous out of faith will live.
But as is the tendency of a daredevil when faced with the specter of death, Shaul was so transfixed by this damning and deadly prophecy regarding him, he cited it again, this time at the beginning of his most famous letter.
For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from belief to belief, as it has been written, but the righteous shall live by belief. Romans 1 verse 17.
Shaul and Satan are taunting God. Their collective arrogance is unmatched. Moving on, there are six specific details in this next prophetic statement from Yahweh, all of which implicate Shaul 600 years before he incriminated himself. But one clue in particular removes any doubt about whom God is warning us about because Yahweh identifies his foe by name. If you are a Christian, you may want to pay special attention to this.
Moreover, because the intoxicating wine of the man of deceptive infidelity and treacherous betrayal is a high-minded moral failure, he will not rest, find peace, nor live. Whomever is open to the broad path associated with Shaul, he and his soul are like the plague of death. And so those who are brought together by him, receiving him will never be satisfied. Most every Gentile will gather together unto him, all of the people from different races and nations. Habakkuk 2 verse 5.
In 1 Corinthians 11 verse 20-21, Shaul/Paulus tells those who have joined his assembly not to participate in Passover, which is the ultimate plague of death, and not to drink wine in association with it, which thereby nullifies the symbolism associated with the blood of the Passover lamb. This serves as a treacherous betrayal of Yahweh's instructions regarding the narrow path he provided to salvation. Attacking the core of Yahweh's plan is the epitome of presumptuousness and immorality. Those who ascribe to such moral turpitude die. Those who promote it will find themselves in Sheol along with Shaul. And yet, Pauline doctrine is popular, providing for those who are open to it, man's broadest path to destruction. Yahusha will differentiate this same immensely popular and broad path from the Torah in his instruction on the Mount, revealing that religious affiliations lead to death and destruction. Shaul promises the gift of life, but his religion, the most popular ever conceived, is the plague of death. Shaul promises heavenly rewards to those who place their faith in his gospel of grace, and yet those intoxicated by this myth will find no satisfaction or contentment. They will remain estranged from God because, unlike Yahweh's assurances in the Torah, Shaul's hallow promises will all go unfulfilled. And that means that the people Shaul claimed as his own, the Gentiles, individuals from many different races and places, will suffer the consequence of his New Testament. Even if Shaul had not been condemned by name, with the mention of the Gentiles, or the ethnos, races, in Paul's parlance, Rabbis Akiba and Maimonides have now been eliminated from the potential list of contentious culprits, not that it isn't already obvious. These religious stalwarts corrupted Yahudim, not Goim. Pauline doctrine has influenced more people and more places in this world than any other corruption of Yahweh's testimony. And the means to this madness is consistent with Yahweh's prophecy, in that Paul inferred that God had authorized him to alter the requirements upon which Yahweh has already taken his stand. Shaul, like Satan before him in the garden, shortchanged Yah's testimony, removing his directions from their context to beguile individuals into believing that God had instituted the changes. Every time Shaul quotes Yahweh, it is always a terse reference which is lifted as an object of scorn to ridicule the Torah, most often with these elusive references serving as cliches, simple adages which are easy to articulate and remember. In spite of this, and even though Shaul means question him, nary a Christian considers the irresolvable conflicts between Paul's letters and God's word. So while the following continues to identify the culprit, most Christians remain oblivious to Yahweh's prophecy regarding them or him.
They do not ask questions, any of them, about him. Terse references to the word they lift up as taunts to ridicule, along with allusive sayings and mocking interpretations. There are odd and perplexing questions which need to be asked of him. And they should say, woe to the one who claims to be great and increases his offspring, neither of which apply to him. For how long will they make pledges based upon his significance? Habakkuk 2 verse 6.
Sean will dismiss all those who would dare question him, claiming that by doing so they were opposed to God, that they were satanic, when the opposite was true. And speaking of truth, the reason religious belief systems like Christianity are adverse to questions is because those who do so lose their faith. Evidence and reason seldom matter in matters of religion. It is only the believer's pledge of allegiance which is considered binding. Besides, now you know why this book is entitled Questioning Paul. Turns out, it wasn't my idea. This final statement is associated with the previous prediction. It is rendered from the Dead Sea Scrolls because the Qumran text differs considerably from the Masoretic.
And he loads himself down with thick mud.
God is saying that the only thing caved, weighty and significant, about Shaul is that he has covered himself and others in muck. Methinks Yah was poking fun at Shaul's murky and messy prose. We cannot say that we were not warned or advised. God even told us how to respond to this horrible individual. He wants us to stand up against all forms of corruption. Political, religious, military, and economic. We are to confront lies and liars.
Why not quickly for a short period of time rise up and take a stand? And those of you who are bitten and are making payments to him, wake up from your stupor, moving away in fear of him. Because you will be considered plunder, victimized by them. Habakkuk 2 verse 7.
Only Paul among those who claimed to speak for God solicits money. It is why Christian clerics embrace him. So following his example, his instructions, Christian institutions have made merchandise of men, and worst among them has been the Roman Catholic Church. Yah is trying to rouse these victims before it is too late. But there is a consequence.
Because you have plundered, stealing the possessions of so many Gentiles, so they shall loot and victimize all of the remaining nations by means of the blood of humankind and also through the violent and cruel destructive forces terrorizing the land and Yah's city, and all of those living in her. Habakkuk 2 verse 8.
Paul mercilessly attacks Jews throughout his letters, making them the enemy of his new religion, thereby creating the anti-Semitism that ultimately took root in the Christian church. Paul, a Roman citizen, seeded the hatred of God's chosen people that boiled over 70 years later with the destruction of Israel and Jerusalem by the Emperor's legions. It happened just as Yahweh predicted it would. 700 years from the time this prophecy was committed to writing, Jerusalem was sacked, Israel was salted, and those not murdered by Rome were hauled off into slavery. According to Yahweh, to be cut off from him is to be estranged from the covenant, thereby excluded from this relationship and forsaken, which is to be damned. Therefore, you do not want God to say of you what he said of Shaul.
Woe to one who is cut off, coveting, while wickedly soliciting ill-gotten gain in relation to him setting his house and temple in association with heights of heaven so as to spare the acquired property and possessions from the paws of fellow countrymen. Habakkuk 2 verse 9.
It is difficult to know if Can is the contracted form of Kana, to acquire wealth, Canaan, nest, Kenets, snare, or more likely Kana, acquire property and possessions, even Kana, jealousy, envy, religious zeal, and sexual passion. But in this context, I suppose they would all apply. The Roman Catholic Church, which was founded on Pauline doctrine, not only constructs gold-laden cathedrals and has storehouses filled with tens of billions of dollars of ill-gotten gain, they have positioned themselves as having sole possession of the keys to heaven. It is interesting, however, that recently they have had to return more than $1 billion to the families of children their priests have molested, priests following the Pauline mandate not to marry. We are not yet at the point in this book where I came to first understand the point Paul was using to foist his plot on the unwary. But 600 years before he conceived and articulated it, Yahweh was cognizant of his scheme.
You have deliberately decided upon and considered the advice of another to promote a shameful plot to confuse those who approach your house, ruining and reducing by cutting off many people from different races and places and in the process losing your soul. Habakkuk 2 verse 10.
This answers a question I'm often asked. Did Paul deliberately perpetrate this fraud or was he misled? It also affirms the now obvious connection between Paul and Satan, the very spirit Shaul claimed had possessed and coded him. Since Beth serves as the basis for Bereth, covenant, God is inferring that Shaul's new covenant is a shameful plot designed to confuse the unwary. And make no mistake, Paul routinely referred to himself as the father of his faithful children, and thus of his covenant family. He wrote about life in the household he had conceived. To be cut off from Yahweh's one and only covenant, the very covenant Shaul condemned in Galatians, is to die with one's soul ceasing to exist. So while the perpetrator of this crime will endure forever in Sheol, the souls of his victims are reduced to nothing, their lives squandered as a result of Shaul's shameful scheme. God has a lot more to say about Shaul, and while we need to move on and continue to expose his letter, I'd be remiss if I didn't share a couple of additional thoughts. First,
woe to the one who causes and allows his companions and countrymen to drink, thereby associating them with this venomous wrath, but also making them drunk for the purpose of observing their genitals. You will get your fill of shame and infamy instead of honor and glory. Inebriated, in addition, you also show yourself unacceptable, going roundabout over the lack of circumcision. Upon you is the binding cup of Yahweh's right hand, therefore public humiliation and indignity will be your reward and status. Habakkuk 2 verse 15-16.
Pauline doctrine is poison, venom from the most vile of serpents. But more indicting still, Shaul, who never knew the love of a woman, provocatively expressed his love for a young man, Timothy. And even though Paul detested circumcision, and spoke hatefully about the sign and requirement of the covenant, he personally circumcised Timothy. Furthermore, Shaul so craved recognition and status, he heaped it upon himself. But here God is saying that Shaul's poisonous attack against circumcision will come full circle and slather him in shame. The man who claimed to be God's exclusive apostle to the Gentiles has become the man of infamy. I dare say, in the whole of Yahweh's prophetic testimony, no prediction is as dire as this one. But that is because no one ever did what Paul has done. It was not required of anyone else. If nothing else, Yahweh has provided his evaluation of Paul and his assessment of his followers. In this light, the only way to view him and his religion favorably is to ignore God and estrange ourselves from him. The debate now is between good and evil, because the issues are white and black. We will question everything Paul says and writes, and we will hold him accountable. It may be too little, but it is never too late. In the most favorable light, what comes next, had it been set into a different context, might have been designed to reflect the shamer, observational, view of the Torah. Many, if not all, of its instructions are vastly more valuable to us when we study and understand them than they are to us when we habitually do them irrespective of their intent. In this regard, the symbolism of circumcision is even more important than the act, although both are essential to our ability to respond to and engage in the covenant relationship with God. That is not to say that we should simply disregard our Heavenly Father's advice. If you want to be included in the covenant, if you want to be adopted into his family, and if you want to be invited into heaven, if you are not currently circumcised, get circumcised. For example, as we shall see, with Yahweh, male circumcision is a life and death decision, one in which he is unwilling to compromise. Therefore, my point is simply that we should seek to understand all of Yahweh's instructions regarding life in the covenant and then respond rationally based upon what we have learned. These things known, Paul's statement is misleading. In fact, without the proper perspective, it is actually counterproductive.
To the contrary, not even Titus, a Greek being, was compelled to be circumcised. Galatians 2 verse 3.
The reason for bracketing the clause "the one with me" is that it isn't found in Papyrus 46, the oldest witnesses of this statement. Those who may place greater confidence in the MCREYNOLDS English interliterate associated with the Nassau-Lalland Greek New Testament, 27th edition, here is that rendering for your convenience and consideration.
But not Titus, the with me Greek being was compelled to be circumcised.
So much for the myth that the NAT 27 has been updated to reflect the oldest extant manuscripts. There is nothing posterior to P 46 and they ignored it. Regardless of one's preference or interpretation, someone actually trying to share Yahweh's message would have provided some context and an explanation as to why it would have ever been appropriate to force anyone to do anything. God does not issue mandates and there are no obligations. We are all free to accept or reject the covenant. The choice is ours, and it is offered under the auspices of free will. So while there is nothing associated with God which is obligatory, and no choice should ever be compelled, an explanation would have gone a long way toward helping people understand the symbolism involved in their decision regarding whether or not to be circumcised. It is after all life and death. And that is because while circumcision does not guarantee participation in the covenant, or thus salvation, a man who dies circumcised has no chance of either. If Titus remained uncircumcised, his soul no longer exists or it is imprisoned in Sheol. Few things are more obvious to the observant than Yahweh does not anakazo, compel. He is first and foremost a proponent of free will. The decision as to whether or not to circumcise our sons, or to become circumcised ourselves should our parents fail to prepare us for the covenant in this way, is ours to make as parents and as individuals. Those who choose wisely position their children and themselves to enjoy the covenant's benefits. Those who don't are automatically and summarily excluded. The somewhat complementary acts which serve to demonstrate our acceptance or acknowledgement of the covenant are circumcision and baptism, albeit the former is required and the latter is purely symbolic. The Torah's sign demonstrating a family's acceptance of the conditions and benefits of the covenant, and denoting their desire to be included in it, is circumcision. The symbolism is hard to miss, as this sign deals with the part of the male anatomy responsible for conceiving new human life. And since three of the covenant's greatest benefits are eternal life, cleansing leading to perfection, being born spiritually into Yahweh's family, water baptism became a symbolic act demonstrating life, cleansing, and rebirth. We are immersed in water as an outward declaration that we have chosen to be born anew from above into God's family, becoming His adopted children. Understanding both is useful. And while circumcising our sons is advisable, and being circumcised as a man essential, there is also expressive merit associated with the symbolism of baptism.
End of part 2.